I'm always of the opinion that the thing that really holds your ear to modern music is that are the mistakes. That I find those very interesting, and I would prefer to find the mistakes in a piece of music and build on them, structure them so they become an integral part of the music, which has happened a lot, although you wouldn't know it now. But there's an awful lot of mistakes on that album that I went with rather than cut them out, and the mistakes in themselves became very interesting pieces to work with.
Hi there. Welcome back to Album with me, Arslan Mohammed. And welcome to part two of my monstrous mega chat with the British comedian, author, podcaster, and fully accredited Bowie beast, Adam Buxton. You might recall from our last episode with Adam that he was introduced to the Bowie universe at the age of 10 when his wise art teacher played the class Scary Monsters and Super Creeps, which is really a wonderful bit of education, and frankly, much more than any of my teachers ever did for me. During that first part of our chat, Adam and I mentioned time and again the wonderful writings of Chris O'Leary, the blogger and author, and former Album to Album guest, who was talking about David Bowie's 1967 debut. Chris had published an in-depth study of Scary Monsters around the 40th anniversary of its release last autumn, and that was some writing which was absolutely wonderful, and it really inspired us when we were researching our chat. So in this episode, I invited Chris to join us down the line from his home in America to weigh in with his own observations and comments. We also talk a lot about the awesome 1980 video edit by the mysterious Nacho, which is out now on YouTube, in which a selection of studio footage, interviews, Elephant Man rehearsals and performances are all banded together to give a thrilling insight into this, the most exciting and accomplished of Bowie's career years. The link, in case you haven't seen it yet, is in the notes for this show, along with tons more stuff and info on our two callers onto the show today. Our chat today kicks off with the majestic Ashes to Ashes and wends its way to the final gasp of It's No Game Part 2, with plenty of digressions, musings, random impersonations and anecdotage from Chris and Adam. And it was really good fun to record. I had to chop tons and tons of stuff to get it all down to a reasonable runtime, and that was incredibly hard to do, but I think that's quite a good sign, really. But on with the show. And I really do hope you enjoy this resulting chat with Adam and Chris. Please don't forget to like, subscribe, share, and review this podcast across all your social medias. It's really, really appreciated. By the way, I'm recording this intro on the 8th of January 2021, on what would have been David Bowie's 74th birthday, and a day that for so many of us summons mixed emotions. So much has been said about Bowie since he died that in some ways it's still hard to remember he's not actually on the planet any longer. I mean, it really has been very weird indeed since he departed, hasn't it? Thank you for joining me, Adam and Chris O'Leary, and I'm big fans of both of yours, so having both of you on this podcast is an opportunity for me to fanboy extensively, which I shall be doing over the course of the next hour or so. So yeah, that's what's going to happen. But we are gathered today to talk about Scary Monsters, which Adam and I began talking about in the previous episode. And given the fact that we kept referring to your book so much, Chris, I just thought it made sense to have you join us. On the 40th anniversary of Scary Monsters, this past September, you posted a long blog post on Pushing Ahead of the Dame, in which you covered big themes and some more obscure themes about the album. I don't think this is something you do with every album, is it? You don't publish such an in-depth think piece. Why did this album particularly motivate you to revisit it?
I think because, you know, the book is so centered on the music. And this was a record that I had all this other research for, because there's so much other stuff, the video, obviously, and the design of the sleeve, because the person who did that, Edward Bell, did a memoir a couple of years ago, which is pretty interesting. So there's all this other stuff I couldn't use. So I figured, well, why not, you know, use the 40th anniversary as an excuse to just get all this stuff out finally.
It came at a good point, didn't it? Because that was when there was a lot of stuff being shot for TV shows, interviews. There's just a wealth of material that is available. And there were so many things that he was doing at that point, and all the Elephant Man stuff. I think myself and Arslan were watching the Nacho video edit of a lot of that Elephant Man promo material from around that time.
Yeah, and he's on Johnny Carson. It's like he's doing all this stuff.
And it's great as well. It's great as well because it's like, it's all good. Like, he is still at the peak of his powers and he's looking terrific and he is funny and articulate and he seems like he's in a good place and he's enjoying being stretched creatively, doing the Elephant Man. He's just made one of his best albums and, or he's just about to make one of his best albums. And then sort of towards the, it goes a bit pear-shaped towards the end of the 80s and Lennon being shot. And well, that spells the end of the whole New York part of his life, doesn't it, really?
Lennon killing, was that really such a motivating...
Understandably, I think he must have had obsessive fans who wrote him deep, long letters and things like that. I'm sure, you know, he knew there were people out there who would consider him in the same way that Chapman considered Lennon, and probably really freaked him out.
Well, as we saw at the end of the Nacho video just now, I remember it was very poignantly put. The night after Lennon's killing, there were three empty seats in the front row. One where Chapman would have been, and two where John and Yoko were planning to have been as well. So, yeah, it wasn't sure if he had plans to have stayed in New York. Otherwise, I saw those film clips, and I just thought, God, he's looking good. Oh, the roses are back in his cheeks again. He's looking healthy. Because, you know, normally when you see mid-70s or even late-70s Bowie interview footage, he can be quite edgy. He can be, you know, not entirely at ease and looking sort of a little bit not quite comfortable. Whereas in that wealth of material that was on this documentary, he is really, really looking good and looking very happy and very confident. And I think the validation he must have had by doing that stage play, an incredibly challenging role, must have been a huge boost.
Yeah, although I must say, I have to confess that watching Nacho's YouTube edit of all that stuff was more than enough Elephant Man for me.
Do you think you could have not sat through 2 hours of it on stage then?
Oh, mate, it reminded me of everything that keeps me away from the theatre. Just, it's all so big. And also, nowadays, of course, I don't think you could do a production like that for all sorts of reasons. But it was just, ooh. Because I suppose he was reconnecting with that part of himself, the Lindsay Kemp phase of his life, all that mime training and everything like that, which I don't know. I mean, much as I appreciated that and enjoyed seeing it, and it was an enjoyable curiosity at the beginning of his career, I quite liked it when he moved away from it. And so when he comes back with a vengeance as John Merrick, it's like, whoa, mate, that is big.
But weren't you amazed and astounded by his mastery of physical theatre? Didn't you gasp when he managed to convey the agony of this poor man in without any props at all?
I mean, he is good. There's no question. I've always been a big champion of Bowie as an actor. You know, when I was getting into him in the 80s, the joke was, oh, Bowie's such a terrible actor amongst my friends. But I never really bought into that. I thought, because I had grown up enjoying The Man Who Fell to Earth, which I saw when I was quite young. That was my introduction to him acting. And I think he was very well cast and well directed in that. And he was in that phase of his life where he was fairly strange in all sorts of ways anyway, so he couldn't have been more perfect for the role. But I thought he was terrific in it. I really did. I thought it was an excellent performance. And he's just got charisma, you know, and that's no small thing. And so I've always enjoyed him. And I thought he was good in... He's been good in a lot of things he's been in. He was good as the hitman in, what's it called, the John Landis one, Into the Night.
I beg your pardon? I've been watching you ever since you left Caper's yacht. Very impressive.
I am?
Stop performing now, Ed. If that's your name.
What are you talking about?
Okay. I represent Monsieur Mavi. I can assure you that he can be far more reasonable than the Savak.
The Savak?
The Shell Secret Flute. Death Squad. Iranian Gestapo. Shaheen's Boys.
Chris, do you think that at the beginning of the 80s, he had pretty much cleaned up as far as his drug habit was concerned?
It seems like it. I mean, I don't know for sure, but he seems to be, as Arslan said, he looks healthier. And I think just the strain of having to do a Broadway show sometimes twice a day, I think he had to be sleeping well and getting vitamins at least. You know, he couldn't just live the way he did in L.A. in 1975 anymore, just to pull that off.
Right. But it's funny with his, when you look at his hair around that time, I'm a very superficial person, so I'm always looking at these things. But you can see the hair is in mid-transition to that big 80s bouffant. And that sort of mad hairstyle that ended up being the bleach white bouffant that he had for the Sirius Moonlight tour. And which Todd Haynes kind of parodied in Velvet Goldmine. That
Billy Idol kind of.
Right, with the big mullet as being a kind of symbol of a rock star who was no longer in touch with his fans, really. You know what I mean?
Very much so.
What period are you talking about, Adam? Are you talking about the early part of 1980? Because I noticed the big quiff on the Saturday Night Live show when he's doing Life on Mars. Kind of, it could have gone either way, couldn't it? But he did tone it down a little bit around the time of late 1980.
Yeah, all it takes is a couple of inches, and you've gone from a cool rockabilly guy to a big, stupid mullet guy.
Reached Ashes to Ashes on side one of the album, and we hadn't actually really got into the meat of the song because we'd been so distracted by the sheer bonkers wonderfulness of the video. Adam, I think we'd been talking about how it had been filmed down on Pet level. Before we carry on anymore, Chris, do you have any observations or thoughts on that video?
It's a little unclear kind of who the biggest influence was on it, whether it was Bowie or David Mallet, was the most was in control of the visuals more. But it definitely seems to be Bowie had the idea of the Pierrot, the clown, as being sort of the defining image of this album. And it definitely seems as if he knows this is going to be a transition album. I think it feels like he knows this is, maybe it's because it's a new decade, but it feels like this is going to be the end of something. So it has that weird funereal tone to it sometimes, of the idea of Major Tom being buried or the clown disappearing into the ocean. It feels like the end of something. And he has all these kids with him who are his imitators, basically, like his children, the Blitz kids.
Yes, who are all dressed in their kind of religious cult garb, and he is the leader of that cult, and they're walking along doing their kind of gnomic weird choreography that looks like a you know, some ceremony going on at the Vatican or something. But talking about Nacho's video again, the edit on YouTube of all that 80s stuff and the scary monster stuff, he has some of that original footage from the Kenny Everett show. So that is what, 79, the Christmas special that Bowie was on and performing that lovely stripped down version of Space Oddity.
Yeah, that's the beginning.
And for that, right, that's the beginning. And that crazy sequence in the kitchen with things just blowing up in a very health and safety emergency type way, with like explosions going off right next to him, it looks like.
I wondered what that was about, that scene in the kitchen. It wasn't going to be something like Cook Along with Bowie or, you know, At Home with David. Obviously, it meant something incredibly tense and urgent.
Yeah, I guess it made sense for Space Oddity because it was supposed to juxtapose this idea of the man in his tin can and he's strapped to this techno seat, but he's there in the midst of this very domestic scene with his wife, presumably, at the kitchen sink. Meanwhile, all these sci-fi tropes are at work. Things are exploding right next to him. He gets his face almost blown off at one point. And there's tubes everywhere. So it makes sense for Space Oddity, but when you transplant it to Ashes to Ashes, it's even more bizarre. It's really abstract at that point.
Yeah, it's completely abstract. I was thinking today about how they arrived at that particular narrative, all the symbolism of that video, and I guess the Blitz Kids in the video is a big part of it, because as we go through the album, especially on side two, there are a lot of references there to his, those who have inherited Bowie's mantle or who are perceived to have inherited Bowie's mantle and his thoughts about them. But it's also a video that often talks about just in terms of its scale. I mean, people talk about it as the most expensive video of all time, certainly at that point, and something which was colossal in ambition. But as we were mentioning last time as well, there weren't that many outlets at that time in the UK, certainly, for a video to be seen. So it is a really quite remarkable piece of work. So we come on to the song, Ashes to Ashes, and a song which Charles Shaw Murray said something along the lines of, minute by minute, there's more information in this track than in any other song ever written, ever.
That's certainly the way it feels. I mean, it really connects with something very emotional, and it feels as if it's just got such a massive emotional scope to it. And because all the sounds are hard to identify, at no point do you think, oh, this is a guitar, and, you know, this is a guitar with some reverb on it and or some distortion, and these are every sound in it is hard to pin down. It's like, what is that, a sort of piano thing, or what's going on there? But it's not synthetic. It's not obviously like synthesizer sounds. So it's caught in this midway point, like 1980, I suppose, between a 70s traditional guitar rock sound, Bowie's past, and then this synthetic machine future. But it's this very strange, really enjoyably odd blend of the two. That's how it sounds to me.
Yeah, everything's really processed in it. But when you break it down, he is using more or less traditional instruments, isn't he? There's piano, there's guitar, analog drums, all of that.
The thing is, the vocals have that kind of great layers too, where he's sort of muttering. If you have the headphones on, you can hear him underneath his lead vocal, you know, sometimes groaning or muttering or making asides.
Do you know what he's saying there, Chris?
Sometimes it's hard to make out, right? It's like, I wish, you know, that's kind of where you'd love to have an archival thing where they broke all the tracks down just to show how it all came together. Like Visconti did that for Heroes, if I remember, on some documentary. Mm.
Yeah, that was great. And I seem to remember some story about a sort of broken piano or something.
Yeah. I think there's odd sort of loops in there, and it's all analog. It's all, you know, cutting tape. So it must have been taking forever to make this mix.
Because what is Chuck Hammer doing? I keep hearing the name Chuck Hammer, and I'm like, ooh, Chuck Hammer, and everyone's like, oh, the legendary Chuck Hammer. I'm like, who the hell's Chuck Hammer?
It's just the name. Just the name's legendary. I mean, he doesn't need to have actually done anything. Chuck Hammer.
Yeah, he invented this thing he called guitarchitecture, uh-huh. Which was sort of using guitar synths and also like layers and layers of reverb, sort of at once, kind of thing. And I think Visconti recorded him in a stairwell to kind of get the sound even more spacious and strange.
So which bits is he doing then on there?
I'm trying to remember, because I think at the very end, the high stuff, I think that's synthesizer. But again, it's been a while, so I am not being definitive here.
He does that bit, that beautiful bit, when he sings, I never did good things, I never did bad things. Mm. Behind that is a kind of huge, shimmering sort of chorale-style sound. And apparently that's what Chris was talking about. That was the part where Visconti went out into the fire exit or something of the studio complex and put an amp down the staircase and then put a microphone a few flights up. And so you get that huge, gorgeous, wonderful sound. Next time you hear the song, you'll really notice it. It's just absolutely beautiful. But the guitar architecture I don't know. You've got your Frippertronics and your guitar architecture. It was all happening in 1980. Chuck Hammer said it's to expand the guitar's sonic vocabulary and is contextual and process-based. So there you go. And they used a Roland GR500 guitar synth. And the big thing was the infinite sustain. You can tell I'm just reading all this off Wikipedia, right? And it was the infinite sustain which creates that wonderful, rich, dense texture. So yeah, you pile a few of those on top of each other, and then you get what I think of as the curtains at the back of Ashes to Ashes. You know, just those wonderful, rich, shimmery textures.
I love that bit. I mean, that bit, never done good things, never done bad things, that's the sort of emotional core of the thing.
Mm.
And in a way, I always thought that was the bit that spoke to me loudest when I was getting into the album when I was 10. And I didn't know why. And then when I was older, I thought, well, that sort of sums up Bowie in a lot of ways. You know, a kind of for someone who could be quite extreme and experimental, he was also he sort of walked a middle path in a lot of ways. Like, he didn't want to be too overtly political, for example, a lot of the time. He didn't want to alienate potential audiences sometimes, but, you know, then there's lots of examples when he did, and he was happy to do so. But he was always happy to just do whatever, you know, to inhabit whatever role needed inhabiting at the time in order to get what he wanted.
Yeah.
And so that kind of person is a never done good things, never done bad things person in my mind.
And he was always, kind of fantasized about being an avant-garde artist, but he was fundamentally a pop artist. I think that was the tension. And he always wanted to sell records. He didn't want to. Scott Walker, I think, fascinated him because Scott Walker made albums towards the end that, you know, it was like take it or leave it. It's not meant to be on the radio.
And I think I always imagined that in Bowie's mind, he was sort of criticizing himself. Oh, I never done good thing. I never done bad. I never did anything out of the blue. You know, I'm pretty predictable, really, when it comes down to it. And maybe his fans might not think of him that way, but maybe that's the way he thought of himself sometimes. I don't know. I'm guessing. Maybe I'm projecting.
Have you done anything out of the blue, Adam?
No, I never have. Never done good things. Never done bad things. But I always thought as well of that bit that it was very Eno-esque. I always thought, well, this reminds me of the sort of ambient textures that Eno would add to things to create a cinematic mood, you know, and something that really lifted those songs out of just being kind of rock and roll. Instead, it was very widescreen, and it was like, holy Moses, this is everything kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely correct that you pick on that particular lyric, because to me that is the crux of the song. You know, the song kind of pivots on that moment. It kind of opens up, doesn't it? When Chuck Hammer's guitar textures come in and there's, I never did good things, I never did bad things. To me, it's almost like a huge euphoric moment of just being able to say something. So yeah, there's definitely a massive emotional punch to this. Do you think that this is necessarily Bowie himself being honest about himself, or is he putting a few layers between himself as, you know, David Jones, artist, pop star, and this persona?
Yeah, I think it's always dangerous to assume that he's speaking autobiographically about anything. I think in some ways he regarded David Bowie as a character himself, and would sometimes speak about David Bowie as if he was somebody else. And also he was incredibly savvy about what people had written about him. He read all his press, everyone said. He read every review. And so he knew that people would called him calculating and manipulative and shallow and image-centered. So I think he's playing with that in part.
Listening to the songs on this album, you hear time and time again in the lyrics, interpretation. You could interpret what he's saying as being a very personal reflection on his own, you know, aging, his own life, his own circumstances, and his thoughts on the generation behind him. I'm also curious as to what you think about that as being another layer of artifice. I mean, as another character, like you said, he sees David Bowie as a construct, as a figure, a puppet almost, sometimes, that he manipulates.
Yeah, but that's a classic thing that lots of artists do, is hide behind characters. And the big thing for Bowie was trying to outgrow the characters and then just appear as himself, which he was doing towards the end of the 70s. And he didn't need to lean on the characters so much anymore. And he didn't need to do all the mime stuff and have the mask that he took on and put away. And, you know, that's why I guess he was tying up the loose ends and saying goodbye to Major Tom, who was one of his first characters. But then being a pop star, that's an ongoing process of characters, isn't it? All he was doing was dropping the obvious artifice and beginning a phase where he was engaging in something a little more subtle, perhaps. It's like when Stuart Lee, the comedian, talks about Stuart Lee on stage and differentiates between him on stage and him as a person. It's a very subtle thing. Yeah, there are some aspects of you being a different person when you're on stage, but it's also slightly bullshitty as well. You're still the same person, really. It's like you're having your cake and eating it.
He's certainly found a lot of inspiration in Major Tom. Major Tom being that sort of lost character from the 60s, circling back around. He hasn't really referred to Major Tom at any point in between 1969 and 1980, but I found this interesting quote, him talking about that character. Actually, Major Tom made that choice not to come back. His choice was to stay in space. But Major Tom is still important to me. He was the first credible character I created, so I've got a really special place for him. He was my own ideal of what I wanted to be, an anti-hero. He was an aspect of the American dream that took off, but that didn't work out, which is what I talk about in Ashes to Ashes. If he had made that decision to move away from the theatrics to an extent, consign those costumes and the masks to history. And another clue that that's what was on his mind is the cover where we see the Berlin albums that have been painted over in the top corner. You know, it's a very, very clear signal that these are being put away.
Oh, yeah, because they look like stamps,
really,
don't they?
A strange time for him as an artist. Obviously, he comes back and does a similar thing for the cover of the next day. But all the signs do seem to point to what you're talking about, you know, turning away from the past, looking to the future. And it must be terrifying as an artist.
And there's a practical side to it in that he decides around this time he's going to wait out his contract with RCA because that means he doesn't have to share money anymore with Tony DeFries. 82 is the end of that. So I think he's sort of like, maybe I'm not going to make another album until then for financial reasons. And so that's part of the finality too. And he hated RCA by that period. He was complaining about
that. Yeah, they weren't friends.
They weren't friends.
Even though he left them with Scary Monsters with a number one.
Yeah, I mean,
he
went out.
The album was number one, wasn't it?
Yeah.
He was fulfilling his obligations as a pop star by all that press that we've just seen that he was doing in 1980. So he was certainly playing the game. Although Baal itself was the final kiss off. So God knows what they made of that. It's not Young Americans Part 2, is it?
Not really.
No, that confused me when I first heard it as an 11-year-old. What the hell is it? It's so weird to think that it charted. I mean, it charted in the UK. I remember hearing Baal's theme pop up in the top 40 countdown and thinking, like, what is this? This is not what I signed on for. But now I listen back to that stuff and I love it. So we should probably move on, otherwise we're going to be here for the next 10 years, aren't we?
Well, I had planned actually a decade-long examination of Scary Monsters. One last thing I want to say about Ashes to Ashes was apparently it was very heavily inspired by Inchworm.
Oh, yeah. That's right. I heard him say that, but I couldn't hear it.
Yeah, it's maybe there in the rise and fall of the vocal. My guess is that one thing I argue is that I think some of Buddy Holly's Peggy Sue Got Married is in there too. As an idea.
Do you mean that three-note riff?
Yeah, or like some of the vocal choices. And also that's a sequel song also. So it's maybe in there too. It's another song about a famous character from a song coming back.
Wow, I've never heard that. That's interesting. I'll go and listen to that. Actually, while I remember, Aslan, I was going to say that on a previous episode of your podcast, I had my mind blown with that fact about Red Sails from Lodger being a complete ripoff.
Oh, like they could have sued if they wanted to.
Of Harmonia, the track Monza.
It's mental, isn't it?
Cut and dried plagiarism.
It is amazing. It is such a steal. I mean, he was so immersed in that scene at the time. I mean, God knows how they must have reacted to that. So
he is a stealing man. But he is a great stealing man, because even though you listen to that harmonia track and it's pretty much the same, it's like a sort of instrumental version almost. But Bowie's is better. Red Sails is better. It's got a great vocal performance. It's got some real emotional heft and punch to it. It's my favorite track from Lodger.
Really? And it's my favorite track too. Not many people like that track that I've spoken
to. Oh, I love
to,
so it. I love it.
I know. Fantastic.
Far away. I think it's terrific. And so that, for me, is perfectly reasonable bit of smash and grab. Even though I do think... I'm surprised that he wouldn't say, like, we should credit it. We should put in brackets, you know, thanks to Harmonia.
So, fashion. Last track on side one, and a very angular, brittle, funky kind of counterpoint to Fame, don't you think?
I think so, yeah. We were talking about sort of the fripless version of the album, and it's interesting, the single edit does cut a lot of him out, and there was discussion on my blog years ago when I wrote about it that a lot of people like it, that version, more. The fripless version.
Yeah, because Fripp is very much like just dropping a load of Tabasco in your sweet, sweet cocktail a lot of the time. And sometimes it's very enjoyably spicy. But there are times when you do find yourself thinking, oh, this is really screechy. And what would it be like if it was a tiny bit smoother? Also with Fashion, I always quite liked the Robert Palmer-esque beginnings. With him, with them all going, ooh, Jamaica. Just a kind of celebrate. I imagine them all in their sandals, holding their pina coladas. They're having a wonderful holiday. Let's do some jamming, guys. What should we sing about? I don't know. Well, we're in Jamaica. Let's do a song about Jamaica. I don't know if that's how it... Is that how it came about?
Possibly. It feels like it. Yeah, it could be.
I think that's exactly what happened. Just sitting around in flip-flops and pina coladas and let's do a song, guys. Let's do a song right here. I actually feel that the Fripp works quite well here. The Fripp. I actually feel Fripp works quite well here because the song is so angular and it's so boom, boom, boom.
Yeah.
That his scronky, squealing, serrated guitar lines actually provide quite a good, you know, dynamic there. I really like that.
Yeah, definitely. It's great. And it's nice and, again, very well produced by Visconti, who kind of enables the thing to breathe. There's so much on Scary Monsters that could easily just turn into a bit of a mulch and just a mess of sound. But actually, he manages to really make everything... He manages to sit everything in the right place most of the time, I think. Even, well, we'll come to Because You're Young, which is the big overblown production number, but I love it. You know, I just think this sort of widescreen type of music. And Fashion's good. Nice and stripped down. Funny lyrics. Beep, beep. Which is presumably, well, supposedly that's Rupert the Riley.
Yeah, I was wondering if that goes back to Rupert the Riley. Seems possible.
I mean, Rupert the Riley is a fascinating theory, and I'd not heard that before. I read somewhere that it was part of his ongoing battle against Gary Numan and a piss take of Cars.
Oh, that's a good theory.
That does seem a bit tenuous, though. I'm not sure. I would prefer it if it was Rupert the Riley going on for mile after mile. Do you think that the lyrics, I mean, there's obviously a certain disdain to the lyrics there. Listening to it again recently, I just thought there's certainly been quite a journey from give me your hands, you're wonderful, to, oh, you're a bunch of idiots, aren't you? Fashion.
Yeah, but I mean, did he ever embrace the kind of Fashion crowd completely? I mean, the closest he got to it was being married to Angie, who certainly was of that world and embraced that world. But I think I always got the impression that's one of the reasons they didn't really last in the end, was that Bowie didn't appreciate that crowd.
Idea?
Well, I can't carry on being Ziggy Stardust forever, can I?
I was thinking that maybe you could.
No, 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 Angie, it's starting to interfere with my id.
Oh.
I need a different mask, a different character to channel my energies. Here, look, I've come up with a few, see what you think.
Okay.
Okay, here's the first one. Cobbler Bob.
Did you say Cobbler Bob?
Yes, Cobbler Bob. Cobbler Bob, Bob is a cobbler, there's a hole in my soul.
Who is Cobbler Bob?
It's an aspect of my psyche, Angie. You know, Bob, like David Robert Jones.
I don't know. I mean, look at the Warhol crowd and how he gravitated to them, and then the dresses. I think he was for a while. I mean, I certainly think it was part of an era for him, and I think he was quite happy to put that to one side. As we were talking about earlier, when he transforms or evolves into a different persona, certainly post, say, Station to Station, that extravagance had gone, hadn't it? Quite markedly so.
I think some of it may have started with DJ on Lodger, because he was talking about what drove that song was his conception of the DJ was another job, like another draining 8-hour job with people, you know, yelling at you if you weren't doing it right, and kind of like the fun had gone out of discos. So I wonder if that led to this idea.
Because there aren't any pictures of him that I'm aware of at somewhere like Studio 54, are there?
I don't think so. I mean, he's more Berlin nightclubs for him, I think. He's in some of the new wave clubs. There's some shots of him like at Hurrah and the Peppermint Lounge and the Mud Club, I think, with Devo. He's there. So that was more his style, the downtown New York.
Those backstage shots with Blondie and Chris Stein, I think, were they CBGBs? Or
I feel like he was more that than Studio 54.
Yeah, exactly. Because if the hedonism that he was into, like if he was going to hang around with a load of flamboyant queens, then they would more likely be kind of Romy Haag and people from that cabaret type, you know, Berlin scene, rather than the very kind of hedonistic New York clubbing type of scene that I don't really associate him with.
I thought you were going to say that I don't associate with. I thought that's very glamorous of you, Adam. You're more you're more a Berlin demimonde man yourself.
Yeah, no, they're all those scenes are begging me to get involved, but I stay aloof.
Let's dive deeper into that scene with Teenage Wildlife. Bowie himself has said, oh, maybe this was a warning for a young man not to get too arrogant too quickly, but no one ever asks me for advice. They tell me what to do. Haha, it's not me talking disparagingly about the younger generation of whom I've got conflicted feelings. What do you guys think?
I mean, it feels like it's his first midlife crisis song in a way, and I think it's driven by being in London and seeing these young people who basically are just taking stuff he did and using it for themselves. And I think he's flattered, but he's also irritated. And he's just like, geez, I am 33. And these kids are 20. And, you know, it does get hard sometimes to see that slip away from you.
33. Oh, my God. But I mean, the big rumor, I suppose, is that when he's talking in the lyrics about some of these young pretenders, he is referring to Gary Numan. And there is the story about Gary Numan being slung out of the Kenny Everett show in 1979 when they were doing the Christmas special. And there's a interview that Gary Numan did with Michael Bonner in Uncut in 2019 where he talks about it. So I'm going to do my Gary Numan impression, which is quite similar to my Bowie impression, but I would say that is probably apposite, because Gary was keen to be a bit like David. So Gary said, in the 80s, I did the Kenny Everett show and Bowie was on too. I was a massive fan. I'd seen him countless times. I had an embarrassing array of bootlegs. The chance to even be remotely near him was an honour. But he asked for me to be thrown out of the studio and then taken off the programme, which was very disappointing. But as the years have gone by, I understood far more the way he saw things then. He was still a young man with ups and downs in his own career, and I think he saw people like me as little upstarts. But later he said some nice things about me, so that made the whole thing better. So that's nice. They buried the hatchet. But initially, I mean, if that story is true, that Bowie was made aware that Gary Numan was in the house, and Bowie just thought, that Ponce, he's just ripped me off from day one, and now he's doing really well, and everyone's taking him seriously as a robot pop man, and I'm not having it. Have him removed! I mean, I just can't believe that he did that. It seems so uncharacteristically petty.
Yes, very much so. Because normally he was very supportive of younger artists, and this was like an exception where he really seemed to have an animus towards Numan.
Hello, Numan.
In this song that he's talking about, to paraphrase the lyrics, he's talking about somebody who's basically a one-trick pony. Is it that first line? You know, how come you only want tomorrow with its promise of something hard to do? It could be said that that's something which is just putting Numan and his ilk down, because Bowie's boredom with copyists or with anybody who's trying to cling just to one dull idea was very well known. So, yeah, personally, I don't think that he would have had him slung out. I can't quite see, I agree with Chris, I can't quite see David Bowie doing that. But then who knows?
Yeah, I just think it's bizarre. But it's... I love the song, though. I really do. I think it's kind of sprawling epic. There's no real chorus there, except when every now and again, he'll just sort of go, another piece of teenage wildlife. And that's kind of your chorus.
That's it.
Yeah.
But the rest of it is just like this tumbling stream of thoughts and ideas. And a lot of the lyrics I never really deciphered properly. I'm looking at them now on Google, and this is the first time that I'm understanding some of that. Those midwives to history. I didn't realize he was saying that. Those midwives to history, put on their bloody robes. I'd never understood that it was midwives to history.
Somebody once asked him who those bloody midwives were. And he replied, I have my own personal bloody midwives. We all have them. Mine shall remain nameless. For the sake of the song, they're symbolic. They're the ones who would not have you be fulfilled.
It's so good at looking at these lyrics, man.
The great insult of, I don't know any hallways. I feel like he has that kind of great put down of like, when they ask me something and he goes, I don't know any hallways. It feels like it's a real barb, like, I don't know.
The same old thing in brand new drag comes sweeping into view. As ugly as a teenage millionaire pretending it's a whiz kid world, you'll take me aside and said, well, David, what shall I do? They wait for me in the hallway. I say, don't ask me. I don't know any hallway.
that's a real like Bob Dylan 60s kind of like, you know, I'm beyond you.
What? Yeah, because the thing about Bowie, I think sometimes, and on this album, especially Scary Monsters, sometimes the lyrics are so out there that you can't really get a handle on what he's on about. And maybe it's, you know, maybe it's just him doing his cut up thing. And it's, he just likes the sound of the words and they're not meant to mean all that much. But actually, on a song like this, there's a lot going on and it does make sense and you can pull stuff out of it. He really was a great lyricist, I think.
You sense the song before you really hear it. I think it's the whole performance, it's the whole work. You know, there's no, like you're saying, there's no sing-along chorus. You know, there's definitely very deep emotion. And to go back to this midlife crisis thing, I mean, at 33 in 1980...
Early midlife crisis.
Early midlife crisis, yeah, but by
rockstar standards, yeah, it's like dog years.
Yeah, it must have been a very strange place to be.
And sadly, of course, it turned out that it was the midpoint of his life, more or less. And he was living life at such a clip and had packed in so much already and was going to pack in so much more that he must have had a sense that most of us don't get until a few decades later that, like, whoa, I'm halfway gone or I'm halfway there.
Wow. He did say in 2008 about this song, Teenage Wildlife, oh, I'm still, bless this song, I'm still enamoured of this song, and I would give you two modern loves for this anytime. Ironically, the lyric is something about taking a short view of life, not looking too far ahead, and not predicting the oncoming hard knocks. The lyric might have been a note to the younger brother or my own adolescent self.
Hmm.
So there we have it.
And where's the music? I mean, because the music it feels like a kind of new wave Bruce Springsteen thing.
That's a good point, yeah. It has that rambling Springsteen quality to it, lyric-wise, too. Early yeah. Springsteen, like, you know.
I love it. It's such a... I think it might be one of my favourite songs of his.
Again, like you were talking about in Ashes to Ashes, there's a huge emotional heft here as well, isn't there? There really is. It comes through every line, I think. And Chris, what you just said now about Dylan, again, in the way that it's this sort of outpouring, this torrent, like Dylan was doing in the mid-60s, again, just like endless couplets and lines and mental images coming, tumbling one after the other. Yeah, incredibly powerful.
Because it's, and it's long too. How long is it?
Yeah, 7 minutes, I think. 8 minutes.
7 minutes. And it just doesn't, for my money, does not outstay its welcome at all. It's just great. I can't think of too many other songs at that length that really earn their running time.
So, Teenage Wildlife, we agree. That's a hit.
Love it. Thumbs up.
Love it. Thumbs up all round. It screams like a baby. I just want to begin this by telling you what Bowie said. I think this was on the NME interview in September 1980. I don't believe in high-tech society, music, computers and so on. Huh, how those words would come back to haunt him. I think society is on a more human level and I see it becoming much more anti-tech. The dreadful 80s. I lapse into future nostalgia and this song reflects that, taking a past look at something that hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, I never picked up on any of that.
Nor did I.
this is by contrast one of my least favorite. But having said that, you know, I was listening to the album again before we spoke, and it's good. You know, I mean, it's like I was complaining in the other episode when I was talking to you, Arslan, about which one, about Scary Monsters, the track yeah. Scary Monsters, and saying that I didn't love it. It was a bit of a racket as far as I was concerned, but it's really good.
Yeah.
And Scream Like a Baby is really good too. It's just, for me, it doesn't have, it's just a bit more of a kind of,
I get what you mean. I feel the same way about it. It's never been one that I go to.
It's more like a kind of fringe play.
Yeah.
Like a really dour, weird play with someone trying too hard to be weird. That's how it comes across to me.
Yeah.
But there's a lot to like in it. I think it's the bit like, now I'm learning to be a part of society. And I was thinking like, oh, come on, mate.
But that's the song. That's a story. He's been brainwashed. The state has won. And David has been battered down. It's again, we're going back to 1984. You know, his pet thing about the totalitarian state crushing all dissent.
It reminded me of a sort of sixth form play, you know. That would be the line that the person who wrote the play was proudest of. Yeah. He's trying so hard to be a part of society that he can't even say the word society.
And there'd be a lot of strangulated acting on that particular line, clutching the throat. It is very Diamond Dogs-y. Something like this could have been on Diamond Dogs. And, you know, it's that kind of story narrative. Him and his presumably lover, Sam, was targeted by the state. And Sam was a gun. And he never knew his last name because they never had no fun.
No. And then you got Return of Very Speed. First time since... All the Mad Men, maybe? I don't know.
I think so. I don't...
Beaulieu Brothers, maybe? Well, for me, this feels also... Like, Diamond Dogs is a good one, but it also feels Man Who Sold the World-ish. Mm. Sort of the sci-fi and the voices and sort of the abrasiveness of it. It feels like a throwback to that period.
Yes. Like Savior Machine, something like that.
Yeah, it's like Savior Machine.
And the bit, you know, in All the Mad Men, where can the horizon lie? When the nation hides its organic minds in a cellar, dark and grim, they must be very dim.
He followed me home, mummy. Can I keep
No him? Athletic program, no discipline, no book. He just sat in the back seat singing, "We seek revenge," but he jumped into the furnace singing old songs he loved.
Yeah, it's totally that era of like.
Yeah.
Was this the one with Pete Townsend?
No, that's because you're
young. That's because you're young.
That's because you're young, yeah.
Is that is that the only song that Pete Townsend does on Scary Monsters?
Yeah, I believe so.
Oh, okay. And the others, when we hear kind of guitar theatrics in the other tracks, that's generally Fripp, is it?
I think so, yeah. We'll get to it, but Tom Verlaine was supposed to be on Kingdom Come, and it didn't work out in a funny anecdote of Visconti's.
Can we get to it now, Orslan? I'm now mangling your name, trying hard to approximate the pronunciation we agreed on in the last episode. And I'm trying out, did you notice I'm trying out like about six different pronunciations?
it's rather like me and Wymondham.
There you but, go. Give us another blast.
Ursulan.
Ursulan.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's originally a Central Asian Iranian name.
But if I don't, like, if I'm just using it in conversation and I don't want to do that thing of suddenly switching to
Everyone just says Arslan, and that's Arslan. Absolutely okay. Fine.
Right. Mum's gone to Arslan. That's a reference to a commercial for a shop called Iceland here.
So for Kingdom Come, it's a song off Verlaine's first solo record. And because they were in New York, they invited him because he lived there. And according to Visconti's autobiography, Verlaine spent hours testing every single amp in the studio, which was, you know, dozens of amps, to the point where Bowie and Visconti were like, all right, we're going to go have dinner. And they leave him. Still testing amps, and they never use him.
Oh my God!
Didn't he order lots of amps in, like some higher?
I guess like it was the power station. He must have had like every single high end amp from 1980 there. So he probably was, you know, going through the toy store in a way.
What a mega nerd! And why didn't they use him though? Just because they just ran out of time and
Or maybe it just didn't work out. It's right. Okay, but. It wasn't like they never came back, but I just love the idea of them going, let's get some Chinese food and we'll see you later.
Yeah.
It's actually quite funny to imagine they just never came back and just left.
That was it. That was the last day of the album.
He's probably still there right now. But I read somewhere, most likely your blog, Chris, that it was Carlos Alomar who suggested to Bowie that they cover this song.
Yeah, because it's a strange choice of a song. It's not a single or anything. Bowie always had some strange choices in what he covered, but it usually had some kind of personal connection to him. And this one seemed very much like, okay, I'll do this one. Because I think he was curious about the New York scene, and this was sort of a way to maybe be part of that or homage it.
Brilliant, man. I love this one. I think it's so good. Again, another bit of virtuoso production, I think, from Visconti. Just that, those first chords, this kind of soaring away. It's like you're just lifted up into the sky, you know. I think it's terrific.
I love that flanging, you know, the really wonderful, big, skyscraping guitar that goes across it. That is, yeah, absolutely gorgeous.
And the histrionic vocal, because this is before his vocal histrionics got a bit much, most obviously on an album like Tonight. But here it's great. I really love it. It's sort of so warbly, and but still very new wave and very odd.
It's not one of my favorites. I'm not a fan of the vocal. I like Bowie's when Bowie is Bowie, like really doing it. This is like the bridge too far for me for some reason. I'm not sure. It's like, right, because I can't deal with it.
It's like a mad impression of him, isn't it?
It's just absolutely over the top. Yeah. And I appreciate it for what it is, but it's like...
It's funny, because he did the same thing when he did God Only Knows, of course, although that was even more...
It feels like it's the ground floor of what becomes God Only Knows.
Well, this is what I was talking about earlier. Adam, I don't know if you've read Chris's blog post about Tonight, but just read his entry about God Only Knows, and it is, like I said, an absolutely superlative piece of writing.
Yeah, I have read it. It's great.
Chris, I kind of get what you mean, because it is... It's not very likable very mannered, very heavily stylized way of singing. You know, it seems to be a bit unnecessary, really. That's what I thought.
Fair enough. But, you know, it's funny, if you listen to Tom Verlaine's original, that to me comparatively sounds very plodding, and it sounds very sort of uptight, and it's not very loose, you know, and there's so much swagger to Bowie's version.
Yeah.
It's like a pirate anthem or something. That's how I see him on a big galleon swashbuckling and standing at the front and warbling away.
Do pirates warble? Well,
I
could get behind that. I like the breaking no rocks thing, because I think we mentioned this last time. There's a lot of rocks being broken in this album, aren't there?
Oh, yeah.
Throw a rock against the road, it breaks into pieces. Here he's not breaking no rocks, and we're going to come to some more breaking up pieces of rock in the next song. You know the chorus. Been breaking those rocks.
Yeah. I always thought it was a kind of prison thing. Yeah, because of that. You know, it's like he's on a chain gang.
Yeah, I've always thought it was like a life as a prison sentence kind of thing.
Mm.
Yeah,
there's a kind of echo in that when he covered Cactus, don't you think? There's obviously a similar sort of thing going on there.
The Pixies song.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he likes all that sort of deserty...
jail cells in the desert.
Yeah. It's just the way he phrases the lyrics in this. With the river so muddy, but it may come clear. And you don't know, like, what the hell is he on about? It's just sounds, you know. But now I'm looking at the lyrics, I can see, well, the river's so muddy, but it may come clear. But when you're listening to it, it's just, with the river so muddy, but it may come clear. You know what I mean?
It's a bit just, like Brian Ferry, isn't it? It's got that kind of like...
And also because Tom Verlaine wasn't like a grandiose singer by any means. He had a pretty limited range, so this is all Bowie putting new extensions on a pretty basic melody.
Right.
Maybe that's why Tom Verlaine got a bit pissed off and rather passively, aggressively didn't play on it by pretending that he needed just to try one more amp.
Yeah, maybe he heard an early version and just thought, oh dear, I don't know if I want to endorse this.
He thought, I'm in a bind here because I'm Tom Verlaine, but that's David Bowie, and I can't tell him that it's shit, but I could be really annoying and just not choose a guitar amp, and that way they would have to.
It must be weird, though, if you're in a position that Tom Verlaine was in at that point, where you're still one of the young upstarts, the up-and-comers, and Bowie is very much like the elder statesman, and it must always feel like, ooh, am I getting him like when he's off the boil? You know, am I going to guest on one of his tracks on his stinky old man album? Maybe I just want to stay.
Consonant old man album.
Yeah.
Great. I get old Bowie, 33-year-old Bowie. God, I'm such a loser. I know you met Frank Black a couple of times. What did he say about when Bowie covered Pixies songs and meeting him and stuff?
I never really talked to Frank Black about that sort of stuff too much. I mean, he loved it, I think. It was a great honor. He loved Bowie, and he just thought it was wonderful that they covered the Pixies. So he was excited about it. But he always called him Bowie. That's the thing that mainly... You know, there's people that call him Bowie and people that call him Bowie, and I'm always just a little bit like... It's pronounced Bowie. It's definitely pronounced Bowie. But Bowie himself said, like, it doesn't matter, does it?
Bowie was, you know, far more magnanimous than I am. I mean, just now in that Nacho clip when Tim Rice is going, well, David Bowie has been acting, I'm just like, oh, God.
Yeah, that's right. It's like, come on, mate.
It's not difficult, for God's sake.
His son, he called his son Zoe Bowie. And it's like, all right, maybe it was pronounced Zowie. But it's not pronounced Jowie Bowie, which he changed his name to, you know what I mean? There's a good line on a Frank Black song called Western Star, and that which name checks Bowie, although it is pronounced Bowie on that song. Now he's, now he's heading skyward, standing up on piles of plywood, and all he thinks about is how he looks like Heroes period Bowie.
Because I'm young, don't mean it's all right. Because I'm young, don't mean to over, 'cause it makes me laugh.
Because You're Young. Probably my least favourite song on the album. Why did Pete Townshend come onto this? I don't know.
It feels like Bowie wanted to use him, but the song does not seem crafted for Pete Townshend, even though the story is that, you know, basically Townshend is in the studio, and this is a period when he was drinking pretty heavily, and I think he would down a bottle of wine to begin, and is asking Bowie and Visconti in the control room, what do you want from me? And they're kind of talking to themselves, and then finally they're like, you know, Pete Townshend chords. Like, do your bit. Do the windmills, please. And he did. So.
Which, I mean, that's presumably the thing that all artists dread hearing. I wouldn't have been surprised if he'd just smashed his bottle of red wine and stomped out at that point. But it's quite... I quite like this one. In fact, I absolutely love this one. And I'm aware that most people seem to agree it's the worst track on the album. And for some people, it's like one of the worst songs that Bowie ever did. I've sometimes read. But I always loved it. And I love everything about it. And I like Pete Townshend's crazy melodramatic guitar. It sounds like an episode of Scooby-Doo, you know what I mean? When they drive up to the haunted house. And there's lightning.
I've never thought of it like that before, but yeah, that's spot on.
It's really overwrought, the whole thing. And you feel as if, like, wow, could they possibly chuck more sounds on this one? But I really like it. I think because it hit me at the point when I was 10 or 11, when I was just into that, when it was like, yep, more sounds, great. Scooby-Doo, brilliant. And then
bring it on.
Also just I was beginning to have a slightly more complicated emotional life, you know what I mean? I think I just responded to it. Oh, yeah, I know. A sad thing happened in that a friend of mine was assaulted around that time, and she was young, you know, she was 12. And it really upset me, and obviously it was terrible for her. And it was this thing, you know, she was walking home one night, and then I spoke to her on the phone about it, and she was very upset, and I was really upset for her. And then I listened to the album, and the song came on, and it was like, because you're young, you'll meet a stranger some night. And suddenly it had this very sinister meaning to it, but it was so sort of tragic and overblown and just epic, and I don't know, it captured the way I was feeling for some reason. So it means something very particular to me, I suppose. But I really do like the track, and I think there's some great bits. Like there's a bit after the first verse when it suddenly sort of locks into a parade ground march, you know, with the drill sergeant shouting, "It's all back to front and no sides." And then suddenly it's like Pete Townshend sort of goes, wow, 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 wow. And then you break away from the parade ground and the drums suddenly start to swing, you know, instead of having this lockstep beat, doo, 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 suddenly it's like they're swinging, and then you get the lyric, "These pieces are broken." And I just thought, that's a cool way of saying broken. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's a very counterintuitive bit of phrasing. And so I love it. All these little parts have always really appealed to me.
That's a good defense of it.
Where are you on this, Chris? Are you...
I didn't like it in the beginning, but I think over the years I've come to like it more. I like the sound of it. I think, you know, Townshend's good on it. So I'm okay with it.
It's got a weird kind of garage punk vibe to it. You know, it's got that sort of question mark and the Mysterians, like, reedy guitar, maybe. What is it? A Farfisa, maybe? And then it goes very Stranglers-ish. You know, there's kind of like clusters of keyboard phrases that go round and round and round. That really reminded me of the Stranglers stuff around that time as well. So there's that kind of edge to it going on as well.
Maybe the Damned as well. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, definitely.
Quite a sort of slightly campy goth feel to it.
Well, I think the first word is psychodelicate, which is about as campy goth as you can get, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the question is that years later, you know, Townshend did that album called Psycho Derelict, and it was like people asked, like, was he inspired by this song? Did he ever listen to the song after he recorded it? 50-50 chance. Yes.
I always thought the line was, "This pizza is broken." And it wasn't until I saw
this
pizza is broken. And it wasn't until I saw the lyrics now I realized it was the pieces are broken. It's love back to front and no sides. These pieces.
Oh, is that what
broken.
It is? It's love back to front
yeah,
and no sides.
Yeah, it's love back to front and no sides. I've heard that this is Bowie casting himself in the persona of a rather jaded older man. Again, you see, we go back to this, so-called midlife crisis he might have been having. And hitting on a younger girl, feeling a bit tragic and old and past it.
Yeah, it's like a kind of 1950s Hollywood romantic drama with some old crooner who needs to retire and he's still trying to chat up young starlets or something.
That's such a sad mental image. I've got an image of Bowie now in a kind of polyester suit and a big toupee.
Yeah, well, it's Never Let Me Down Bowie, isn't it?
We're not quite there yet. It could be the Young Americans Bowie. You could be that narrator of Young Americans, couldn't it?
Yeah, I guess so. That's the nice way of looking at it.
Well, Adam, this is clearly a special one for you, and we shall honour it as such.
I stand by it.
You stand by it, quite rightly too. We're going to wrap up with the finale now, which is definitely, I think, I don't know about saying it's my favourite song, but I think it's really, I love this moment. It goes back to what you were saying, Adam, about the emotion on Ashes to Ashes. And to me, this song is just pure emotion. This album is such a dramatic roller coaster ride. I love the fact that it resolves on this kind of very ambiguous, disappointed mood, this moment.
And the interesting thing is that for quite some time they were considering having the closer be Crystal Japan, you know, that the B-side.
Yeah, yeah.
And that would have changed
really?
The album, I think,
That's
greatly.
Interesting.
To end it with this sort of placid instrumental instead of the more recursive, you know, back to the first track, but a sadder version, a deflated version of it.
Huh. That's fascinating.
Chris, do you know if it's true that this is, I think it was in Visconti's book, but this is essentially the same track, but he just mixed it differently.
I think it's the first version of it. I think it's the earlier take. I think it works as sort of, you know, it feels like, I think Visconti once described this as like Sergeant Pepper was one organizing idea, and so that has the Sergeant Pepper comes back at the end of that. That might have been one factor in doing that.
But it's not a track that you would put on a compilation, is it? If you were doing a Bowie compilation, you wouldn't reach for It's No Game Part 2.
No, I don't think so.
I would.
Whereas you would, Aslan.
I totally would. Absolutely.
Would you? Okay. I mean, it's good. Maybe it would work really well on a compilation. I don't know. I suppose if you put it right at the end. But Crystal Japan, even though that would be odd, because Crystal Japan sounds so much like a low outtake, that it would seem strange on Scary Monsters. But I love that song. And that it wasn't a low
outtake.
No,
it's just Visconti and Bowie. They recorded it around now. I thought it was a low outtake as well, especially because I thought it must have been... They must have used elements from Subterraneans or something for it. You know, it's got that very woozy kind of undulating bass thing underpinning it. And yeah, you're right. It sounds so much like something for low. Maybe he just felt, you know, that's too much of a harking back a couple of albums.
That's my guess too. I think maybe he felt it was too old hat, or it was too much the recent past, and he wanted to not do that.
So instead, he used it as a gin, was it for a gin commercial in Japan or something?
It's not sake, shochu.
I
don't know
what
it is.
I keep thinking lost in translation.
It's not sake. So. Everyone thought it was sake. It's not sake. It's the other Japanese liqueur.
Crystal. Junrock, Japan.
It's Crystal Junrock. Is that right? What is Crystal Junrock? Crystal Japan was a haunting and quite beautiful synthesizer-based instrumental track that David provided for the Japanese Sake Crystal June Rock advertising campaign. So there you go. That might be wrong. Okay. Anyway, yeah, you can, listeners, you can find the ad on the YouTube.
Because, like, now we can see these ads, but, like, back then, nobody would have known he was doing Japanese liquor ads, right?
No, exactly. That's why he did them. Because there was a whole... That's what Lost in Translation is all about. It was the end of that era of big, big stars going out and doing ads for booze or products that maybe they wouldn't endorse in their home countries out in Japan, because the market was totally separated and there was no kind of crossover. But then the internet came along and ruined it.
Do you think when he was talking to Jeremy Paxman in that very famous interview predicting the rise of the internet, this is what he was secretly praying? God, I hope no one finds my Crystal Japan ad. That would
At some point, they're going to find my bloody sake ad. Or maybe not sake, whatever it is.
But It's No Game Part 2 did make the cut. And I think it really wraps up this extraordinary album. And it is a really extraordinary album. It's something that, the more I've been listening to it and rediscovering it over the last few days, the more I've been thinking that it's the... I know the cliche, the old thing about, oh, the best album since Scary Monsters. But that's absolutely justified, given the massive drop in quality control that followed it and, you know, the long road back up to that synthesis of innovation, creativity and accessibility that is all in this album. Yeah, I think this certainly is the best album since Scary Monsters itself.
It's fun, but it's a good album for fans because you've only got a couple of obvious singles on there.
Yeah.
Fashion and Ashes to Ashes, and even those are odd songs, really. Ashes to Ashes is a wonderful, very accessible song, and so is Fashion in its own way. But apart from that, it's all very much album tracks, strange, oddly structured songs with odd performances and instrumentation and arrangements, but they're all really good, you know, and interesting and solid. It's very satisfying, I think.
Well, as we've touched on over these podcasts, there are reasons for those creative decisions, and that's the thing that's so rewarding and satisfying for it, is that he's thought this through. You can sense when any work of art has been thought through, and there's so many layers to peel back and explore. It's what makes it rewarding. And in this case, there is an awful lot to go into. On the one side, you've got David Bowie himself. You've got this 33-year-old man, obviously looking back over his career, very self-consciously putting the past away. And as we mentioned at the beginning of the episode, you know, a number of different things had come to a natural end by this point, be it his marriage, his record contract, the deal with De Vries was shortly up. The general climate of the rock scene had shifted a huge amount too. He was really assessing himself, seeing what he could do. And I think in tandem with the whole Elephant Man adventure at the end of the year, 1980 really was an absolutely extraordinary, pivotal year.
Yeah, definitely. And final plug for that Nacho compilation.
Yes.
Because he's really dug up some great bits and pieces there. And there's some stuff of Bowie apparently in the studio with the rest of the gang.
The Dam Gang.
Yeah. Brilliant. Apparently laying down some of the, you know, initial backing tracks for Scary Monsters. Where does that footage come from? Do you know, Chris?
I think there was... He rehearsed for the Tonight Show. So I think that... And it was filmed for 2020. I think that was the American show it was on. He was filmed a lot that year, I think, because of Elephant Man. There's a lot of rehearsal footage of him for whatever reason.
It's great. Fascinating.
You see them doing a bit of Up the Hill Backwards and a very early take. And that's amazing. It's so good. They're kind of sketching it out. You've got a lot of George Murray. He's sort of in the center of the screen, just doing amazing things on the bass. And actually, that's one thing I really would like to ask you very quickly, Chris. You mentioned in the blog, sadly and inevitably, they would never work together again. What did you mean by inevitably?
I feel like, you know, Bowie is sort of would draw lines, you know, between periods. And I feel like, I mean, one of the reasons he doesn't use them again immediately is it's practical. Like, he can't keep them on retainer for a couple of years. He's not going to tour. He's not going to do another album. So he kind of lets them go. And Dennis Davis, by that point, was working with Stevie Wonder. So that's where he played. And George Murray retired. I think he became a teacher. It's a fascinating story. So Alomar returns, but I feel like, you know, Bowie was never somebody who got the entire gang back together again. Like, he never brought the Spiders back. He doesn't do Tin Machine ever again after that is over. There's a finale. I feel like once something is over, he doesn't really go back to it in entirety, at least.
This marks really the end of, like I said, so many major chapters in his life, not least the ending of the Dennis Davis, Carlos Alomar, George Murray trio, but then also Visconti. Visconti's now, I mean, they do Baal in 81, but apart from that, Visconti's pretty much out of the picture.
Yeah, for the next 20 years, more or less, isn't it?
Yeah.
Pretty much.
And all the worse for it, it's got to be said. I mean, look, there's lots of great moments throughout the 80s and on into the 90s, but there's nothing as far as an album that comes close to something that was such a complete, coherent statement as any of those 70s albums, don't you reckon?
Yeah, like it has to come full circle and then, you know, work with Visconti again at the very end. You know, I feel like, you know, Black Star holds up in that. It feels like Black Star is sort of the, at long last, the best in Scary Monsters. It really was.
That's right, yeah. And again, you know, there's so much to love on all those other records, definitely. Even on Tonight, you know, which is such a mess in so many ways. But I've got a big soft spot for a lot of that stuff.
Well, I've been struggling to find somebody to come onto this podcast and talk about Tonight. So, Adam, you've just confirmed your next guest appearance right there.
Don't look down. They're making sort of crazy sounds.
Dancing with the big boys. Big boys. Well, there you go. I mean, what further proof is needed? I think on that note, we'll wrap it up, but I just want to really thank you both for your time. Like I said at the beginning of this, I'm a huge fan of both of your work. Both of your works. And so to have you both on this podcast has been an absolute joy. So thank you very much for joining me to talk about Scary Monsters.
Have a good one.
Thanks very much for having me. Very nice to meet you too, Chris. I bid you goodbye. Are we done?
Very nice meeting you.
And that was Chris O'Leary and Adam Buxton in chat with me about Scary Monsters. And a huge heartfelt thanks to them both for kindly joining me. You can find links to all sorts of Buxton and O'Leary goodies in the notes for this episode, and I especially recommend their respective books, Chris's Rebel Rebel and Ashes to Ashes collections of essays on each and every Bowie song, and Adam's brilliant memoir Ramble Book, the audiobook of which will brighten up even the dullest of days, rather like today. Anyway, till the next time, I hope you're safe and well wherever you are and managing to stay sane in these somewhat lively times. Keep in touch with me on Twitter and Facebook. It's at Album2Album. That was Otto the dog just shaking there. And I promise I will get cracking with the next episode as soon as I can. Thank you again for listening. Please share and review the podcast. Take care, and I hope to be with you again very soon. Bye for now.